Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. It used to be called a code of honor amongst big-time criminals. Don't provide information to police or investigators. Whether it be in the movies or some kind of mafia story, that code of honor seemed to be romantic in some way. Today, cooperating with police is often called snitching, and whether it is a code of or the streets or not, witnesses or those with information about a crime often don't cooperate with police because they are afraid of retaliation. There could be other reasons as well. The don't snitch phenomena is a subject of today's Smart Talk. Joining us is York City Police Chief Troy Bankert. Chief Bankert, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you.
Also joining us is Sophronia Perry, the Executive Director of Hope Station in Carlisle. Ms. Perry, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us on the phone is Dr. Susan Clampett-Lundquist, an Associate Professor of Sociology at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, who has researched and written about this topic. Dr. Clampett-Lundquist, I want to welcome you to the program as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, we'd like to hear from you. Why do you think it is that there are so many people who have decided not to cooperate with police or don't snitch? And what can be done about it? 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number is 1-800-729-7532. Chief Packer, I want to start with you. Just a few weeks ago in York, there was a day where there were two shootings in one day. One man was killed, two others were wounded. Afterwards, you asked for the public's cooperation to try and make arrest. You said at that time that that lack of cooperation is not unusual with city-related violence. What did you mean that it's not unusual?
I mean that we typically will not receive information specifically within the first several days of any type of incident, major a violent incident. That particular incident had – both of those shootings were during the day. We had one previously in the previous month that was also during the day. So it emphasizes the idea that – and it was nice out. So there were people outside during the incident. So we're confident that someone saw the incident. And in the neighborhoods – they're likely to know the person by name and face. And you would think that you would receive more information for that because it's actually seen. It's not done at 2 o'clock in the morning and maybe no one saw it because nobody was out. There's clearly people out at the time and there was clearly someone that knew it and we didn't receive it. So I emphasized it on those two and the one prior to as well. And the idea here is that we just do not get any cooperation whatsoever from those whom we know have witnessed the actual act. So we try to put out in our press releases that we have an anonymous phone number, we have anonymous emails, and we have an app that you can go get on, which is completely and absolutely anonymous, and that we can actually send emails back and forth. But they remain anonymous. I do not know who they are. Mm-hmm. The detectives do not know who they are. So we facilitate the anonymity and the anonymous tips so that they can feel comfortable calling, and we still don't get it.
Yeah, you said you used the word typical. Does that mean in most cases when there are violent crimes that you don't get cooperation?
Correct.
I mean, could you put a percentage on that? I mean, 75% or
More than that.
More than that.
Yeah.
So what does that lack of cooperation look like? I mean, when you ask, or I say you, meaning a police officer, investigator, a detective, ask someone they think witnessed the crime or has some information, a question about it, usually what's the response?
They'll just say they didn't see anything at all. Well, we have a couple of tactics that we use as well. And some of our experience tells us that the day of the incident, you get absolutely zero unless it is involving the death of a child. That seems to outweigh
right.
Any type of culture of not speaking with the police. Any type of an extreme egregious a crime. If we have a shooting between two known individuals where one is targeted, Ms. Perry and I were talking about that earlier, where one is targeted or both of them are involved in criminal activity, there is you almost get almost zero. There's two reasons why I think that occurs. One is because of the fear of retaliation, like you mentioned at the top of your program. So if there's two people that are already involved in criminal activity, they're fearful of that. They're fearful of speaking with us. The other one is that sometimes they accept the actual behavior. So if you go beyond crimes such as violence, some neighborhoods, some behavior doesn't seem to be as unacceptable to others. So the more unacceptable the behavior, such as violence against a child, we've had years ago, we had a child, 9-year-old struck. This is going back 10 years now, but I remember it because I was there. And we got all kinds of tips then.
Right.
We couldn't field them all.
One of the things I do want to talk about, I understand that there is a sliding scale depending on what the crime is. Ms. Perry, your organization, Hope Station in Carlisle, you represent neighborhoods.
Yes.
Why do you think that there is adult snitch? And I don't know, I guess I should ask, is there that, does it occur in the neighborhoods that your organization works with?
Yeah, it does. I think it occurs in a lot of the African-American communities. Some of it, I think, is yes, that there is that fear of retaliation. Some of it, I think a lot of it is trust. They don't trust the police. And so they would rather try and either figure out how to handle it within themselves or not say anything just because they don't trust the police. Snitching has always been, you know, you don't tattletale. We were raised like that. As kids, you're told, don't tattletale. If you do, you're going to get in trouble too, because that's not what you're not supposed to tell. And as you get older, you continue that, you know, and especially when it's people that you know, whether you agree with them or disagree with them, whether you like them or not, you don't tell. And then, like I said, there's always that trust factor. And we are fearful. The African-American communities around see, you know, we all watch the news. We all see what's happening. And sometimes it's happening right in front of our faces. And they don't trust the police. And so that just makes it really, really hard for the police to do their job because they're not going to tell.
So that was a question I was going to ask the three of you. Is this something that happens mostly in the Black community?
Now, that I can't say that I know. I know it happens in the Black community. I don't know if it's mainly in the Black community, but I know it does occur there.
So let me bring Doc.
I was just going to say, the study that we did in Philadelphia, we interviewed about 150 young people, 14 to 24 years old. We mainly did our analysis about snitching with the males. But we interviewed white males, Latinos, and also African Americans, and you know, it seemed like there was really sort of this continuum in terms of whether or not you were going to be cooperating with police across the three communities, and we drew from, you know, the highest poverty communities across those three groups, and what really, you know, stuck out to us is that, you know, we did see those types of guidelines around not cooperating with police, you know, in the three communities. And the environment, the context of the situation really makes a difference. So it makes a difference, you know, it shapes your daily experiences, like what your encounters with police are going to be like in the neighborhood. And these experiences affect how you see the world, including affecting your views on the criminal justice system. Like Ms. Perry was just saying, you know, whether or not you feel like, is this criminal justice system actually, you know, something that you can trust in? Is it something that you see that is effective? You know, and there's something that we looked at, which is legal cynicism. And it's this idea that this distrust of law, the agents who enforce it, it's this belief that maybe the police can't ensure your safety. And so that really, you know, affects whether or not you want to put yourself out on the line in terms of cooperating when a violent crime does occur.
Let me follow up
and
on that.
These types of things were were you know, experienced across the three groups.
Well, let me follow up on that, Dr. Clampett-Lundquist. I'm curious. You say that you talked to the three groups. Did any of the three communities, were they less likely to talk to police than another? Or was it pretty consistent?
Yeah, definitely. No, you're right. There was definitely a continuum because we really saw a difference in terms of the policing that they experienced. Mm-hmm. So the quantity and the quality of the encounters across the three different groups varied. Just to give you an example, there was one young man who was a Latino man, whom I'll call Norberto, and he went to high school in one community. He had to cross through like a white community to get back to his neighborhood, and his class schedule ended earlier in the day. And so he would constantly get stopped by police on his way home from school. Some were totally fine with him, just, you know, wanted to check to make sure everything was okay. But he also had some really hostile encounters where they demanded to see his class roster. So you compare that with Fred, who was a young white man who was caught, you know, smoking an illegal substance in a playground. And there he had an encounter with police that kind of, like, I think that we sort of hope for as a community, where the police officer is like, come on now, you know, like, this isn't cool to do in the open, you know, going to talk to your parent about it, and that kind of thing. But it was a very, you know, it was the kind of, like, encounter that we really think can help encourage, you know, social control, like, in public spaces. And it didn't leave Fred with a really negative idea about police officers.
Mm-hmm. So, Chief, what about that? I mean, obviously, we know in the atmosphere that we live in today, especially in some cities, in some urban areas across the country, that there is a lack of trust in police officers. Is that a big part of this in your mind?
It is. We try to encourage cooperation with the police department in one significant way since I've started. And in radio, you can't see it, but we try to make to where the police department is a part of the police department. It's radio, so I have my hands.
He has his hands together. I'll describe
together.
That.
Yeah. You know, as opposed to being a part, you know, of the community. So, that's a long road. You're not going to fix that today. And it, like the doctor had said, Lundquist said, it's something that develops over time. A problem that has developed over time is not going to be solved overnight. But it is individual encounters that make those changes possible. And I agree with her in that the individual encounters with police departments can make that difference. So, you know, we've been trying to do that, but we also we can't do it all ourselves. You can't say the police department, you know, the police department is supposed to do everything for us. We can't do that. That's not possible. We need you.
It has to be a two-way
conversation. It has to be a two-way street. But again, we're not saying that you have to help us. It has to be both ways. So
right.
If we meet in the middle a little bit, maybe we'll get some progress.
I think that one good thing that I liked that happened, our police chief now has been with us
in Carlisle.
Mm-hmm. Has been there, I believe. It's been a little over a year that he's been there, and he's already started this initiative. We actually are calling it the Carlisle Youth Initiative, and I'm a part of that. What he did when he came in is he said, you know, we need to make our kids trust us. We need to make our kids believe in us. We need to do something for the kids here in Carlisle. You know, there was an opioid crisis that's going on there, and, you know, a lot of other things that are happening there. So what he wants to do is bring the police and the community together. I think that even though it's something that I believe is hard, because there is that working with trying to get people to trust you. But, you know, if you can foster some kind of communication with the kids and you can actually be a part of the community, that's where I see the change happening. But, you know, it's a slow process, but it's something that definitely should begin. Because if not, it's going to continue. If we don't feel that the police are coming in to our community, not just to police us, not just to watch us and follow us and follow our kids, but actually to be there to make them feel safe, to have fun with them. My son actually sent me a picture the other week. He was over at the park playing basketball, And he sent me a picture. There was a police officer that was over there playing basketball with the kids.
On duty?
Yeah. I don't know if he was on duty or not.
I'm joking.
I hope not.
We can't win, Scott.
I know.
But he was over there and he was playing. And that's something that they need to see. If trust is going to begin, it's going to have to start with the police and the community working together. Yeah.
We got a lot more to talk about.
I couldn't agree with you more. Can I just say one quick
sure.
example? As part of our study, we've now been interviewing police officers and also people in the DA's office to find out what their experiences are with witness cooperation. And so I interviewed this police captain who had been captain of a district in Philadelphia that was pretty moderate in crime, probably high in crime in the whole metropolitan area. But, he talked about how he had this whole strategy. He said it wasn't about any gimmicks. It was just listening and acting so that people could see concrete action that police officers were taking. And that develops that trust. Like you said, it does take a long time. But once those relationships were developed, he started seeing, people working with police, offering them information. So I think that, one concept that people talk about is this idea about procedural justice. And so it's not so much about the outcome. Like, you may still end up getting arrested, but if you feel like the process itself is fair, then that's going to elevate your idea about procedural justice and police legitimacy.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking about the don't snitch phenomena today. Witnesses or those who may have information about a crime not cooperating with police. As you heard our guest, York City Police Chief Choi Bankert, say earlier today that maybe 80% of the crimes that are investigated in the city of York, that there's a lack of cooperation. That's just an amazing statistic. Chief Bankert is one of our guests, along with Sophronia Perry, who is the Executive Director of Hope Station in Carlisle, and Dr. Susan Clampett Lundquist, an associate professor of sociology at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. She's researched and written about this topic. If you have a question, an opinion, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Clampett Lundquist, I know you have to take leave of us here in a few minutes. So I have had a few questions for you. Okay, we talked about, obviously, I think it's an obvious answer of why this occurs, that people are afraid of being retaliated against. Just talked about maybe a lack of trust in police. But one of the things I wanted to bring up and discuss is this is not anything new. Maybe don't snitch, referred to that way, is. But as I said in my introduction, there's a code of honor amongst criminals forever. I mean, a lot of people, like when you see in TV and movies, has to do with organized crime that you don't. As Ms. Perry said, tattletale on someone you know. So this is nothing new, but what is new or different about don't snitch?
I guess I would think about kind of three things, and I totally agree with you that this idea about a code of honor has been going on forever, and it's in so many of our social institutions, too, about kind of keep quiet about things that go on, as we've been seeing in the news over and over. But first of all, we've seen over the last 30 years, we've seen a quintupling of incarceration rates. So we have, mass incarceration that has affected many communities more than others. And so you have this, that's something that potentially can be undermining legitimacy of the criminal justice system. You also have, with the war on drugs, a heavy reliance on CI, confidential informants, to try to turn people to try to build a case. And so that's something else that, definitely affects, this snitching culture as more CIs might be used. And third, cities, including Philadelphia, really ramped up stop-and-frisk policing, which kind of upped the ante in terms of having these types of encounters on the street that can perhaps deepen the gulf between the police and the community. That's something Philadelphia Police Department has been under a monitoring order from the ACLU since 2010. They have had, they've halved their rate of pedestrian stops, which is the good news. The bad news is that, you know, they still have a situation where less than 1% of their frisk actually find guns. And so this is, you know, you could see that as good on the one hand, that maybe less people are walking around with guns. But on the other hand, what it means is that a lot of people are getting stopped and frisked. Most of them are not even getting arrested. So they kind of feel like Norberto might feel like, why is this happening to me?
One of the things that I wonder about is pop culture, that there have been that the don't snitch mentality has been celebrated in music. Of course, there was that famous T-shirt that many people were photographed wearing and would wear that said don't snitch. It would seem that it would be hard to overcome when that becomes part of pop culture, that you know, music, celebrities, you see other people wearing the T-shirt saying it's not cool to snitch.
I think that for sociologists, we think of culture and structure as totally mixed together, interwoven together. So all of those things that I was just talking about, that shapes, you know, what happens in pop culture. And I think that really the most effective way to try to build that middle ground, like we were talking about earlier, is, you know, is through these types of initiatives that little by little helps to build that trust that has been eroded, you know, through mass incarceration, through the war on drugs and stop and frisk. And it's only when we do those types of little steps that we can, you know, potentially make the cultural difference as well.
Dr. Clappett-Lundquist, I know that you have another engagement, so I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
I've loved being part of this. Thank you so much.
All right. We'll see you. Chief Bankert, let me follow up on what she was saying. What do you think about, you know, some of the things that she mentioned as some reasons that could be behind this?
It's interesting that you bring up the pop culture. We find that quite often in things become popular, and they don't seem to know why. They believe in one thing or another, and because everybody else does. We see that in Facebook quite a bit. It comes and goes. So the two reasons that I had mentioned earlier of why I thought people do not speak with the police, one of the reasons why is a fear and the acceptance of the activity. Those are reasons based on their own experience. When you're talking about pop culture, it's popular because it's popular. That's and that's there's no reason behind it, but they will practice it. That usually is fading. You know, that pop culture usually comes and goes.
And it's one thing to wear a "Don't Snitch" T-shirt. It's another thing when you've witnessed a crime.
Correct.
And you're asked the question, and you are drawn into the situation. I want to talk more about that in just a moment. First, let's take a call from David in Mechanicsburg. David, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I was wondering, on the anonymous tip line, if someone turns in a tip, is it possible that they would eventually be required to testify at a trial to help convict the perpetrator? Does the DA or the courts have any access to the information from the tipster?
Thank you very much for your call. You know, I've always wondered about this with Pennsylvania Crime Stoppers, for example, of how that information that was passed along can be used in court.
The anonymous is anonymous. That we wouldn't even know who you are to call you. When we receive information for an investigation, we categorize it. So we have something that's very strong to very weak, and we do a triage. So if we receive an anonymous tip that this person did this, and then we have on that same crime, we have a witness that says that person did that, the witness information is going to be followed up first. So then when, once we exhaust the best possible avenues of solving that crime and we get to the anonymous calls and anonymous pieces of information, we have to verify everything that is said. So if you call and you say, this person did this, I saw it, I know for sure it is, but I'm anonymous, I don't know who you are. Okay. So I have to prove that other than what your statement is. I cannot use that at all as any type of probable cause evidence to make the arrest.
Prosecutor can't go into court and say we have an anonymous call saying that this person did that.
That only takes
that's hearsay.
That only, that's right. There's no one there even to hear say it too. I don't know who it is. So it has to be my investigation has to be completely independent of that anonymous piece of information. So, for example, there may be someone that we didn't recognize as a possible suspect, and I could go to that person and say, hey, I got an anonymous call, you know, or I received information. We wouldn't say anonymous call, but I'll say, well, we received information that there was this, you know, what do you know this person? And we would just investigate it. All anonymous tips and information has to be proven independently and is never used as probable cause evidence to make arrest.
So it's just another piece in the puzzle.
It is.
Okay. Because, you know, one of the things that – and the reason I ask that about bringing it into court is that, as we know, that those who are charged with a crime have a constitutional right to face their accuser. That's one of the things that makes this even more difficult because you may have witnesses who would come forward, but they are just scared to death that they will have to sit in a courtroom on a witness stand and tell their story with a person who may they know has committed this crime just a few feet away from them.
Correct.
And then if there are not even if they're just anonymous, say a person has decided, you know, I'm going to tell because I saw this happen and I'm telling, you know, when the police go to pick the person up, they have the warrant for their arrest. If their names, the witness's name is on the warrant, then the perpetrator knows who it was.
You've given them information, yeah.
Yes. And so, and not only do they have the information, but then they can give that information to other people that could put pressure on the person or threaten the person's family, however. But, you know, if a name is put on a warrant, that's another deterrent. People aren't going to want their name to be on it. They're not going to want to be the ones who, oh, yeah, this is the person that I see every day that told on
right.
my family member.
Does that happen, Chief? Do you keep witnesses' names off of warrants?
It's not on the warrant itself, but it's on the documentation of the arrest.
You have to do that.
That the defendant will receive through discovery through the defendant's due process rights. On occasion, we can justify sealing some of the information, depending on the crime, depending on the circumstances. So at times we can seal that. We deal a lot with federal agency, DEA, ATF, and the marshals, and we do that more often in the federal system. In the Commonwealth system, we can't do it as much, but we can at times close or seal it so that there is no retaliation.
Okay, you know, we've been talking about several different reasons behind the don't snitch mentality, but you know, going back to the original one, and I'm not in a position to say that this is the one that motivates people not to talk, but it would seem that due to human nature and fear and everything else, that fear of being retaliated against would be one of the biggest and one of the strongest motivations. Have you had occasions in York? And it's the same thing to you where you, Ms. Perry, where you've heard of some cases where a witness has been retaliated against?
Yes.
You have.
It's rare, but it's not an illegitimate fear.
Right.
The fear of retaliation is not an illegitimate fear. And many times the retaliation isn't so much as being a victim of another crime, but just being harassed by other people, being yelled at in the street, being called the name, being ostracized.
Yep. Maybe I'm showing my age by calling somebody a narc.
You know, being disconnected from the only community that they know of, you know. So it's not always the fear of retaliation, the retaliation being a victim of another crime, but it is being
ostracized.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I lost a friend that way.
Really?
I did.
What happened?
Years ago. Did tell. Mm-hmm. She did tell. She cooperated with the police. She did tell. They knew that she told, and she was killed.
By the people who were involved in crime.
Yeah. I was 22 maybe when this happened. So it's been a long time ago. And I just remember coming home from work one day and picking up my son from my mom's house. And my mom had to tell me. And I did not believe her. Like, I didn't believe her, but it was true. And it's something I can't say that it happens. I don't know that it occurs all the time. I don't know that it's that extreme all the time. But in that situation, that was something that rocked Carlisle because it did happen. And like I said, it's been a long time ago, but it did happen.
Did you know, or, you know, eventually when you said it was a long time ago, did it come out that it was in retaliation?
Yeah.
That was the motivation behind
yes.
it? Mm. Was it, what kind of criminal case was it?
Drugs.
Drugs? Mm-hmm. We'll take another phone call here from Dennis in Lancaster. Dennis, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm Dennis in Lancaster. I just want to give a little history lesson because I've read some books about this and whatever. But, I mean, basically, the policing in America, the huge change happened with the Prohibition and also with the drug laws that were created, you know, around 1920, where before that you could do any drug and it wasn't illegal. But, and there were, and also the documentation on this is, you know, because now you have, you know, everything's public that's come out, is totally racist, which is, you know, everything in this country, you know, traces, you know, back, it's in our DNA. But the thing about the drugs was that, you know, black men would do cocaine and rape white women and whatever. And the thing about the Prohibition was that, you know, these Italians and the Irish and whatever that would be drinking were, like, you know, not fitting with the kind of American kind of waspish type of ideas or whatever. So then when we created these laws, then basically, you know, the police kind of went to war with the public, with the, you know, populace, and that's kind of continued ever since, that this kind of mentality of, you know, and that was actually the first start of the mass incarceration and everything, which nowadays has been, you know, exploded. But, you know, the policing where people are, you know, basically incarcerated because, you know, they're doing what they're doing, whether it's drugs or alcohol or whatever it might be. But that's kind of the genesis of the huge increase in policing in this country.
Hey, thank you very much for your call. You hit every stereotype there. But, you know, we know in history some of the things that there is some truth to what he was saying. But the gist of his comment that policing is one of the reasons that this has occurred. And I think he was talking about the lack of trust in police. How do you see this history playing into this?
Well, he has one good point in that the increase in policing in the sense of arrests, and it really came from the 50s and 60s, is that it created an environment of us versus them, right? So as that culture in policing developed, it ingrained it. So then there was a clear distinction between the police officer and the resident. Community policing recognized that back in the 70s and 80s and attempted it. The problem with the community policing was that it coexisted with the same environment that created the us versus them environment. So I think we've gone a little bit further beyond that to where we understand that not just community policing where it's a dictate for a police officer, you will be part of the community, you will do this, you will do that. It's now starting to become a little bit of our culture itself to where I see that in our newer officers that they
just
accept
that. What she was talking about, right? Earlier, what Ms. Perry was talking
so
about
So it's
earlier.
Just like this conversation here. I have these conversations on radio and other places and small groups. We had a very nice conversation with Ms. Perry before. It's a conversation. There's no, don't talk to the cop because he's sitting there in the room. It's I have conversations just like I would if I was not in uniform. And that is the environment that I've seen starting to change I've been there 20 years. So I've seen that a little bit. And now in the newer officers, it's easier for them to accept that. I don't see the us versus them separation as much in the police officers.
But does it still exist in some cops?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. I mean, let's face it. Human nature is when you're putting your life on the line every day, you could be the target of danger. I mean, human nature would seem to say that, I feel like I'm the enemy here.
Well, the officers are always going to feel some sort of guarding, right? So there's always going to be that appearance of detachment from a conversation, specifically when you're at a call. They're concerned about your safety. They're concerned about their safety. You're telling them a story, and the crimes code, the vehicle code is going through their head. The radio is on. So there's a lot of things going on, and that creates what I've been describing as a cold conversation where you and I are looking at each other. I'm looking at Ms. Perry. We're talking. We're having a conversation. And when you call for a police officer and he's talking, you're telling them something that had occurred, it looks like he's just kind of like glossed over and he's just kind of like glazing over.
Just the facts, man.
Yeah, just the facts, man. Right. But this officer's looking at other things. He's looking at other – he's listening to the radio. And while you're explaining the situation, he's trying to figure out, does he need to do a report? How does this fit into a crime? Is this recognizable of a pattern in my area? He's thinking of a lot of things. So what that ends up doing is it creates that cold kind of appearance.
Yeah.
So the idea then is, other than when you're reporting a crime or officers actually investigating a crime, I encourage, and it seems to be more natural in the newer officers, to have a conversation. You're not in the I'm reporting a crime, I'm investigating a crime mode. You're just talking to somebody in the street, and that helps.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when I was saying about a police officer feeling like he or she is the target, on the other hand, someone dealing with a police officer, if they've not had a good experience or they have felt threatened, feel the same way.
Yes. And even just and for a minute, I have to go back to the call, a certain part of the call. I absolutely have to. Even with just the statement that the last caller just made about different groups. So saying that, when black men were raping white women, that they
I think what he was talking about was that. It's what a lot of people thought.
Yes,
back
and
in
that,
the day.
And unfortunately, that's where a lot of the issues are. Is that those types of feelings, those types of fears,
stereotypes, and
stereotypes have always come into play, and so and because of that, our men, our black men, they know that when they step outside of that door in the morning, that they can be stopped just because of how they look, just because of that stereotype, And so, no, whenever they are stopped, whenever they are talked to, and they're questioned about certain things, they don't feel like they're in a safe place with a police officer. So they don't feel that comfort level like, yes, I can come to you and I can tell you about this situation that has occurred. And there have been times when they have called the police and this has happened and maybe their word wasn't, they weren't believed by the police that this is who did it and this is what happened. Sometimes there's been situations where it's been turned on them. Now, I can't say that I know that I've had that happen to me in an experience. I can just say that I know that those types of things have occurred from time to time. So I think that what it truly boils down to is that there needs to be more conversation. There needs to be more conversation about racism, about, the issues that we're facing. In order for there to be some kind of trust built, there has to be relationships, there has to be conversations. And like you said, in speaking with the police chief in Carlisle, and he's talked about the police officers, they're younger. they're younger police officers. They've come, they're millennials, so they've come into a different time. Mm-hmm. And honestly, you know, I can't say that I've had a lot of interaction with all of the police officers in Carlisle. It's not a very big police department, but from the ones that I have had interaction with, they look at it a little differently. They are even probably friends with some of the people that they've known. They've grown up in a different time. Mm. So I think that, you know, there is possible, it's possible for things to change.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking about Don't Snitch, and we have a few more minutes left. 1-800-729-7532 if you have a question or a comment. Maybe you think can talk about why it's happening. Maybe even a suggestion on how to get people to cooperate better with police and investigators. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can go to Twitter. We are @SmartTalkWITF. Our guest today, Sophronia Perry, is the executive director of Hope Station in Carlisle, and York City Police Chief Troy Bankard. 1-800-729-7532. Chief, I have to ask this question. You know, many of us get our ideas of what law enforcement is like and investigating crimes from television or movies. Every single crime drama has a detective, well, every single detective or police officer has this guy that they go to who feeds them information, mm-hmm. the CI, as it's been referred to. Is that realistic?
Completely unrealistic.
Okay. Tell me about it.
We have – I was a crime scene investigator for years, and there is a thing that we – a concept that we train now is called the CSI effect.
The CSI effect.
So what happens is that we go and you get burglarized and there's no fingerprints, which is really rare that we find fingerprints in a burglary, and we don't find fingerprints. She goes, well, what do you mean you don't find any fingerprints? Well, we didn't find any. And I said, well, how do you not find any? Just use your stuff. That those things don't exist.
So then all that equipment that they have,
yeah,
on
well,
CSI.
some of it exists, right, right. But it doesn't exist that they, you know, they solve the crime in an hour. So then when we do find a fingerprint, I was like, well, how long is it going to take? 3 months. You know, and they're like, "Oh, what are you talking about?" Because their expectations is like, you know, I can scan it onto my phone, and all of a sudden, I'm going to know who'd burglarized your home. Not true. I was at a grand jury one time where the grand jury, federal grand jury, can actually ask questions of the witness, and they were asking me questions, and they said, "I watched this on CSI. Why couldn't you do this?" I said, "That those things are impossible," and their eyes are like, "What?" Like, what are you talking about? They completely believe it. And it goes towards a larger concept that we battle in law enforcement, where we oversell ourselves at times. And the media does that, to where if you call the police, they're going to solve it and everything is great. Troy and his guys are going to come in and they're going to fix everything right now. I'm a heck of a guy, but I'm only one, is what I often say. And it's the same with the officers. We all have those limitations. So we cannot do these things on our own, whether it is with the community where we want to get, educate them on one thing or another, or have conversations with them besides just give me the facts, ma'am, or if it's information being received from a specific crime. This is not a one-person problem. This is all of us here, and without someone stepping up and saying, Troy, I'd like to help, how can I help, it's not going to get solved.
But getting back to my original question, though, you don't have a CI you go to and like Huggy Bear and Starsky and Hutch that every single time crime that this guy knows. I mean, it always amazed me that, you know, one guy knows everything about what's going on. He's plugged in.
Some CIs are better than others, but it's not like a Huggy Bear. No, we don't have a Huggy Bear.
Do you have to give them a 20 or a 50?
There's... Yeah, sometimes we do that, yeah.
Yeah. Out of your own pocket or...
No.
No, I got to say...
Everything has to be documented, and at times we can pay for information.
I want to get back to... We've talked about this several times, about, and really what we're talking about here is solution. We've listed trust in police, that we have the conversation between police and the people in the community. People are afraid and pretty much have laid out that we can't protect them in some cases. So it would seem that all these things together would be the solution. But logistically, what makes the most sense is having those anonymous tip lines. PA Crime Stoppers, I hear, okay, $1,000 and nobody knows who you are. You would think that's a motivation for a lot of people. But there's only a certain amount of money that can go for that. I saw in Florida that they actually in the state legislature were thinking about doing something where they provided much more money for people to call some of these anonymous tip lines. Do you think that would work?
No.
Okay. Well, so much for that conversation. No. Okay.
The money itself, I don't think.
You don't think it's the motivation.
We see some increase when we do the Crime Stoppers. We don't do Crime Stoppers all the time, and we give money for other forms of tips. They typically do not do that for the money. Those who give us good tips are those that know that that specific individual is dangerous and they don't want them to hurt them, or that it's more altruistic where that person is going to hurt someone of my family or someone that I know or me himself, and it's better that person go to jail, so I'm going to tell what I know. Those are seems to be larger motivation. We put a lot of time and effort into make things anonymous. We put it out all the time, and it seems to always come down to the individual morality of the person who that has the information.
Mm. So, what do you think, Ms. Perry, would motivate people to cooperate?
I think I agree with the chief. I think it will have to be. And I'll say it over and over again that they feel that trust level, mm-hmm. And that they feel like, okay, I can, if I do this and I can do it anonymously, okay, I'll do it. Because I think that there are people, the ones that don't tell, it doesn't mean that they don't want to, you know. And I think if they feel safe about it, like, yes, I can call and, you know, leave an anonymous tip, that they would feel more comfortable with doing it.
Have you seen, and both of you can answer this question, a difference in age groups? I mean, younger people, it would seem that maybe they want to take things, matters into their own hands, retaliate on their own, be afraid of being retaliated against. But older people who may want to help, but again, are afraid of their family being hurt, that kind of thing. Have you seen that?
Well, I'll say this. I think that with the older people, they want to tell. I think that the older people, and there are some that I know that will tell. They will call the police in a hot minute if they see something that occurs, and they don't care if it's anonymous or not. The thing is that a lot of times, or at least in Carlisle, a lot of times they don't necessarily see what's happened. They may have heard it. Because of, you know, grandkids or nieces or nephews or something like that, but they may not have actually seen it. So they haven't told because they didn't see it, but there are more than a few that would tell.
But see, you bring up a good point there, and I only have about a minute or so left, so I'm trying to squeeze this in. Chief, you know, what Ms. Perry just described there, you get a tip from someone who's giving secondhand information. Is that valuable?
Yes, it's just as valuable as the anonymous tip. Mm. You know, we have to verify all that. We can't go off it. But it goes to another point of reasonable expectations of what your information can give. So I've spoken to several people who said, well, I gave an anonymous tip one time and I didn't hear back. It's anonymous. Okay? You're not going to hear back. Or I gave information one time and, you know, you didn't make the arrest. Well, maybe it wasn't completely accurate because it is hearsay. Hearsay, I can't use hearsay. Someone told me that this person did it. Great, I'll use it. I can follow up on it. It's something I can use. But I cannot use that as single pieces of probable cause to make the arrest, so I have to follow it up. And I said, well, I didn't hear back about that either. but you didn't want to be a witness, and it didn't work out. You know, so sometimes there's a low level. There's a reasonable expectations are high. Again, we're overselling ourselves at times.
We're out of time. I want to thank you very much for being with us today, and hopefully this gets some people thinking. Chief, I would imagine that if you could make a plea, it would be to people just like you have. Please give us some help.
Yes.
All right. Chief Troy Bankert, City of York, Sophronia Perry, Hope Station Carlisle, thank you very much for being
You're
with
welcome.
Us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on Monday's program, we have State Senator Mike Fulmer is going to be here, a new redistricting plan, also talking about cooperation in government, and we're going to be talking a little bit of baseball at the end of next week's program.